thoughts. His relations with the media pack had been prickly and strained. Where Meghan smiled, was putting on her best face whenever she was on show, Harry glowered. On the five-hour flight back from Tonga to Sydney, his press handlers promised he'd come to the back of the plane and thank the media for coming. The hours passed with no sign of Harry and Meghan. Then, after the plane had landed, and it seemed as if it was not going to happen, the couple appeared. As a Times correspondent on that tour, I remember the scene well. Harry looked like a sulky teenager, forced against his will to talk to some unwelcome visitors. Meghan stood a couple of feet behind him, smiling benignly, but not saying much. Her only contribution was a comment about how much everyone must be looking forward to Sunday lunch at home. Harry did all the talking. He sounded rushed, as if he couldn't wait to get back into the first-class cabin, away from the media. "Thanks for coming," he told the assembled press pack, "even though you weren't invited." Even for a man with a deep mistrust of the press, this was spectacularly rude and incorrect. The media very much had been invited to cover the tour. If the couple's casual meet-and-greet moment with the royal correspondents had been meant to repair relations with the media, it had the opposite effect. Later, Harry's staff, who'd spent much of the flight trying to persuade the Duke to speak to us, told him how badly his remarks had gone down. He replied, "Well, you shouldn't have made me do it." Mexit was more than a year away, but Harry's petulant behaviour was a taste of the dramas that were to come. It revealed much, not just about the Sussexes' hatred of the press, but also the couple's deteriorating relationship with their own staff. Although everyone was aware of the tension in the air, none of the media on the plane realised quite what was going on behind the scenes. Some of the secrets of that tour, the reasons behind Meghan's meltdown at a market in Fiji, the hidden story of her diamond earrings, would not emerge for more than 2 years. Two of the couple's advisers would soon be gone. When Meghan's assistant private secretary, Amy Pickerel, handed in her notice a few months later, it would prompt an angry outburst from the Duchess. Samantha Cohen, the couple's private secretary, would hang on for another year. By the time she left, her relief at being able to escape at last was palpable. Back home, Harry and Meghan's communication secretary, Jason Knauf, who was not on the tour because he'd broken his collarbone, was about to compose an email containing explosive allegations of bullying that would destroy what remained of his faltering relationship with the Sussexes and would later create headlines around the world. Harry's behaviour also raised fundamental questions about the relationship between royal and courtier. Who wields the power? To what extent do royal servants play the master? And who, or what, do they really serve? Chapter 1. Starched Shirts. A senior member of the Queen's household, who had originally come to Buckingham Palace on secondment from his job working for the Australian government, was on his way back home when he stopped at immigration control at Sydney Airport. The man at the desk leafed through his passport until he came to the page where the advisor had entered his profession. He gave it a quizzical look, then snapped the passport shut and handed it back. "Mate," he said, "there's no T in courier." This story may have an apocryphal edge to it, but it was good enough to be told that the party marking the departure of one of the Queen's private secretaries, Lord Janvrin, about one of his predecessors, the Australian Sir William Heseltine. Regardless of whether it's true, however, it raises two related points. One is that to contemporary ears, there's something inescapably ridiculous about the word courtier. Who are these absurd characters with their knee breeches and fawning ways, their courtly intrigues and scheming ambition? Which leads us to the second point. The very name suggests someone who's not to be trusted. When the Duchess of Sussex spoke in her interview with Oprah Winfrey of the difference between the royal family and the people running the institution, she knew it was a distinction that would resonate with people around the world. "Ah, yes," audiences said to themselves, "we know what's going on here. There's the royal family, who are blamelessly just trying to do their best. And then there are the courtiers, who are up to no good." These are the men in grey suits, a catchphrase much loved by the late Diana, Princess of Wales. Or the men with moustaches, Princess Margaret's epithet of choice from an era when the wearing of a grey suit did not really single anyone out. They are the enemies of youth, progress and true love, who can be relied upon only to pursue power at all costs and to betray anyone